This song is dedicated to fellow worker Noah.
And the song is Dump the Bosses Off Your Back.
Are you poor, forlorn, and hungry? Are there lots of things you lack? Is your life made up of misery? Then dump the bosses off your back. Are your clothes all torn and tattered? Are you living in a shack? Would you have your troubles scattered? Then dump the bosses off your back.
Are you almost split asunder? Loaded like a long-eared jack? Fool, why don't you buck like thunder? And dump the bosses off your back. All the agonies you suffer, you can end with one good whack. Stiffen up, you ornery duffer, and dump the bosses off your back.
That's no lie.
All right, so now we're going to do introductions with fellow worker Marilyn whenever you're ready to take it away.
I am Marilyn, and I have been a wobbly since I think about 2006. I was a mental health worker for about 25 years, and I go by her and they. And next we have Al, he, him.
Yes, that's right.
And what would you like to say about yourself?
Retired nurse.
Retired nurse.
And a union nurse, and I joined in the last century a long time ago.
Okay. Gordon. And fellow worker Gordon, he, him.
Hello, listeners. My name's Gordon. I use he, him pronouns. I'm a retired shipyard worker, live in Bremerton, been a wobbly since 2008, interested in the liberation of the working class and the liberation of all freedom-loving people.
And next we have Lynn.
Hello.
And Lynn is she, her?
Yes, hi. I'm Lynn, and I've been a wobbly originally since 2007. I'm a retired social worker, and I'm enthusiastic wobbly and wob radio person.
And Noah.
I'm fellow worker Noah. I use he, him pronouns. I've been a part of the IWW since March of 2021. I'm very passionate about the work that I do here. I've been helping produce and edit WOB Radio for the past couple of years. I also write for the Industrial Worker and the Seattle Worker if you receive those publications. That's also available through the IWW as well. And I'm happy to be here.
Okay.
All right. And fellow worker Gordon, would you like to read a section of the preamble?
Sure thing. I'm going to read a couple of excerpts from the preamble to the Constitution of the Industrial Workers of the World. A lot of people ask, well, what are all the books I should get to learn about the IWW? Well, this is sort of our text. The preamble contains all our aspirations and our principles. So it begins, the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. And it goes on, the trade unions foster a state of affairs which allows one set of workers to be pitted against another set of workers in the same industry, thereby helping defeat one another in wage wars. Moreover, the trade unions and the employing class aid the employing class to mislead the workers into the belief that the working class have interests in common with their employers. And it goes on, these conditions can be changed and the struggle of the work and the interest of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one, an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system.
Moving on to our labor news, we have quite a lineup today. Our first and foremost, speaking of local events going on here in Tacoma, the Home in Tacoma campaign is officially suing the city of Tacoma, and this is according to the News Tribune. This article was posted on August 3rd. Fight over renters' rights moves to court. Citizens group says Tacoma is confusing voters. A renters' rights group is suing the city of Tacoma, Pierce County, and County Auditor Linda Farmer in her official capacity, alleging that the city violated its charter when the city council voted to put another renters' rights measure on the November ballot. Tacoma for All's ballot initiative would amend the city's rental housing code to give renters additional rights, including some relocation assistance, the creation of a tenant and landlord code of conduct, and a defense against winter evictions from November through April, among other changes. And as of last month, the City of Tacoma Council passed an ordinance that expanded renters' rights by requiring that landlords comply with city licensing and safety requirements before increasing rent or evicting tenants, setting limits on late fees and pet deposits, and adding new regulations for shared housing, amongst other changes. So the core of this fight, and by the way, this lawsuit is actually being backed up by the United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 367. Hats off to them.
Absolutely.
So the reason why this lawsuit is going on is basically Home in Tacoma for All has so far had a very successful campaign for a tenants' rights initiative. We talked about it a few times on the radio already. Right. It has a very broad set of protections for renters, such as changing how evictions take place, a United Renters and Tenants essentially Bill of Rights, amongst other protections. It was very thorough, and it was specifically aimed to protect renters who might be going through economic instability or might be facing eviction or might be facing other forms of oppression, one could say, from the landlording class in Tacoma. This got a lot of traction. The ballot initiative got accepted after, I believe it was around 8,000 signatures were collected from Tacoma tenants.
We needed to get 7,000, and we got well over 7,000. Mm-hmm. We wanted to make sure that we had enough signatures so that if any signatures were thrown out, we still had plenty of signatures that were valid.
Absolutely. And so basically when the city council heard about this, they introduced a last-minute initiative, which is now also on the November ballot.
I want to interrupt for just 1 minute because this is a tactic that the city has used before. When we had the fight for the $15 an hour minimum wage, they at the last minute put up a competing ballot and confused voters and knocked the legs out under the $15 an hour minimum wage.
Became 12.
Yeah.
Yeah, it became 12. We had plenty of signatures to get it on the ballot. They made sure that they had one that sounded good, the title sounded good. And we went down in flames because people didn't know what the hell was going on. Mm-hmm. And now they're doing it again about tenant rights. And the name of their particular decoy sounds good too. So if the voter is not informed, they are at risk of voting for the wrong one. And the city had the power and passed their own measure at that city council meeting. They don't have to even take that to the voter. I mean, they voted for it. It's part of the regulations now. So there was no need to go ahead and also put it on the ballot to confuse the voter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically the Home in Tacoma for All campaign retaliated against this measure that the city council introduced intentionally to mislead voters, essentially, is their charge. And I believe that it is an accurate charge because, like you said before, the city of Tacoma, the city council has kind of a history of this, whether it's over wages and now it's over renters' protections. As for when this lawsuit will be going through, it's still up in the air as far as I've heard. It's still up in the air as far as I've heard. This has only been recently announced within the past couple of weeks. But we are paying very close attention to it because this renters' rights initiative being introduced by Home in Tacoma would be one of the leading initiatives in this country that we've seen so far, especially within this area of the country, the Pacific Northwest, that's really shown a lot of care and compassion for tenants and specifically legal protections in order to keep them from landlords being landlords, essentially, and trying to evict them by either jacking up the rent prices or evicting them on some lesser charge that they can get away with.
We are really at risk in this city of longtime residents being squeezed out of Tacoma and wealthy Seattleites moving down here because to the Seattleites, our rents look good. But since our wages are so much lower here, mm-hmm. people can't afford, generally, that kind of a hike in rents. Rents have gone up 43% in the last year. 43%.
Yes.
And it's squeezing people out. It's squeezing teachers in Tacoma, can't afford to live here. It's squeezing families where students are longtime Tacoma School District students mm-hmm. having to move out and have disrupted education. So this is for no cause. And what no cause is they have not done anything wrong. They have paid their rent on time. They take good care of the apartment. But the landlord just decides to jack up the rent. And then if they can't afford it, they are evicted. And this would give protection for students, Tacoma School District students, and Tacoma School District teachers. During the school year, during the coldest part of the school year, from evictions, so that they can stay and finish out the school year. And there are other protections in the Tacoma, Home in Tacoma for All ballot. So, listener, please vote for the first one. It'll be on the ballot, and it's Proposition 1. The city's is Proposition 2.
So, vote for 1.
Yes. A yes vote.
A yes vote, vote for one.
Vote
yes.
for.
Thank you.
Actually, here's a good quote here on this News Tribune article from Ann Dorn, who's with the Tacoma for All campaign. It appears on the ballot as a choice for voters. It will make it look like they are choosing between two ordinances, but Measure 2 is already law, and that will not change even if voters vote on it. So a lot of the protections that the city council put forward as a decoy are already part of the law as
That's what I was saying.
Yeah. So, again, we're going to be keeping a very close eye on this, not only because it's happening locally, but because it would probably be one of the strongest tenants' rights initiatives that's going on in this country right now, specifically here in the city of Tacoma. And as a renter myself, I really look forward to these protections because while I have had no bad experiences as a renter with my landlord, I know that my specific instance is not the tenants' experience in Tacoma, and landlords often have very arbitrary and very deafening amounts of legal power when it comes to who they can lease to or who they refuse to lease to or what can get somebody evicted, whether it's a lesser charge or whether it's being late on even just a month's worth of rent, mm-hmm. things like that. So it's about challenging the abject authority of a class of people who, in my opinion, shouldn't be landlords. There should not be landlords in an ideal society, but for right now, we're fighting back against them.
I know that this lawsuit is expensive, and I'm sure that the Home in Tacoma for All organization would appreciate any contributions people could make to help with fund the lawsuit.
Absolutely. And I know that they still need volunteers as well to be a part of this and keep reaching out to tenants as well, make sure that they're okay, and make sure, like you said, this lawsuit gets thoroughly supported. I have not personally seen any links to any kind of GoFundMe or donation site, but I imagine that will be coming soon once the lawsuit hits the bricks in the court, so to speak. So.
And the name of the organization is Home in Tacoma for All. Is that correct?
Yes, yes, it is. It's a
with the number 4 rather than printed out F-O-U-R.
Okay.
So if you go on to Home in Tacoma for All, I think you will find a donation site.
Mm-hmm. Moving on to our next piece of labor news here. The writer's strike is still ongoing. We know that hundreds of thousands of workers are currently on strike, and there have actually been successful secondary strikes from workers who aren't organized or are only parallel organized to the workers that are currently on strike in terms of the writer's strike with SAG-AFTRA. They are currently at the negotiations table at the moment, so things do seem to be looking up in terms of how those workers are going to be able to get pay raises, better protections at work, things like that for their employment. As for what's going to come of those negotiations, nothing has been said so far in exact, but I do have an article here from Reuters, and this was published on the 10th. Hollywood writer's strike marked 100 days on Wednesday, with contract talks stalled and people on the picket lines protesting what they describe as a disregard for their demands. The strike began on May 2nd after negotiations between the Writers Guild of America and the major studios reached an impasse over compensation, minimum staffing of writers' rooms, and residual payments in the streaming era, amongst other issues. The entertainment industry executives have been trying to navigate the cross currents of declining television revenues, a movie box office that is yet to return to pre-COVID levels, and streaming businesses that are largely struggling to turn a profit. I have my personal doubts about that. But the article continues on to say that actors represented by the Screen Actors Guild, SAG, in SAG-AFTRA, went on strike on July 14th, also over pay and artificial intelligence, potentially outpacing them and potentially replacing them at work, leaving them in
It's a big issue.
Yeah.
The AI issue is tremendous, and it should be on the negotiating table for both the actors and the writers, and I would say all the ancillary trades, like the roadies and the equipment people and, you know, costumes and all that kind of stuff. They should be able to fight the artificial intelligence scourge that's coming, because what happens is that if you tell the machine what to write, the machine can do very passable work as far as script writing. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you could write one script and then just be aced out of the whole thing by having an artificial intelligence bot come in and just use your stuff as seed corn for their writing.
Right. And this is not just an issue that's related to writing and art as well. I'm sure many of us have seen plenty of AI-produced art on Facebook or other social media sites. But when it comes to the larger issue of automation, what we're talking about is an industry, an economic system as a whole, that's focused on the profit incentive, on net profit, on making money, no matter the cost, if they can get away with it. So unless, you know, as we like to stress, you know, workers need to control the means of production. And this is a way for production companies, such as these major Hollywood studios, to essentially cut out that production and put potentially tens, if not hundreds of thousands of workers out of work.
Yep.
And you have an entire class of people that is now out of work and struggling to get another career that could also potentially be automated. There is no backup to automation, because the business executives that control the economy want automation for the sake of cutting out labor costs in general, to not have to pay workers that the workers need to live. So this is a very broad fight. Negotiations specifically with SAG-AFTRA are currently taking place. And like I said, there hasn't been any conclusion to this. There hasn't been a contract offered yet. But considering how much solidarity there has been on the picket line and how many people have walked off the job in secondary strikes in support, well, secondary strikes are technically illegal under labor law, but there have been other workplaces that have gone out on strike that were inspired by the current SAG-AFTRA strike. Other producers, other artists, other graphic designers, people in IT and tech as well that work especially in the entertainment industry. Smaller independent studios have even gone on strike, even if they aren't related to Hollywood, in order to say we back up the writers and we're not going to act as scabs in whatever way possible. The solidarity has been astounding, and this is one of the biggest strikes in Hollywood in decades.
Well, one of the other things I heard about that's just raising a lot of uproar is for actors, what AI could do is if they do one episode, the studios are wanting to own the face of the actor to be able to use them in further episodes without paying them.
Yeah.
I read a very interesting article specifically about the AI issue, and I believe it was in These Times magazine, which is a pretty good outfit. But what they were saying, they highlighted a worker in Nairobi, Kenya, and that worker worked with a bunch of others taking apart sentences and filming facial reactions. It's very ironic that the AI program has to be taught first to one machine, and then that machine can teach limitless others. But the thing is, they would have to take, for instance, a 7-second video clip could take hours and hours and hours, all day, next day, just by doing it frame by frame, recording people's facial expressions, recording people's body language, and that is specifically so they can own. So if you're a background actor, and a lot of them, you know, a lot of the faces you see on TV, they're not big stars, but they're journeyman actors and actresses, right? Or
and
just
that's
actors.
How they earn their living.
Yeah. And some of them don't even earn enough I think the cutoff is $26,000-something right. dollars. They don't even earn enough to qualify for the union health benefits. So and we're talking, you know, for every star you see, there's at least 100 background actors or extras, if you will, that are just, that's what they do. That's what their job is. And they're going to be pretty much aced out of the market because they're going to have to sign contracts that say that the studio owns their likeness and image.
Yeah. And we've seen it in previous movies as well. For example, I remember when Carrie Fisher passed away, I remember in one of the Star Wars sequels that they made, they actually used CGI. They had the rights to her likeness, to her image, the studio did, in order to CGI her into a new Star Wars movie. And I can definitely, you're absolutely right. There's a huge threat to essentially having machines do the acting, do the writing, because once they have you scanned in, or once they've mm-hmm. taught the AI how to recreate you, would the studio even have to pay you? What would that contract even look like? So, No, it's an existential threat to the entertainment industry, and not just the entertainment industry. Automation is coming for all of us. Mm-hmm. If they can find a way to automate it with a machine, it means you're going to be out of a job, which means you're going to be out of a paycheck, because a company isn't going to give you a paycheck for existing. They want your labor, or they want you dead. So,
true.
Yeah. And hopefully the actors
get they want our money. So the flaw in all of this is, if nobody has jobs anymore because of AI, mm-hmm. then how is capitalism going to work? Because nobody except for the rich people.
And they're not going to give us universal basic income either, because that's too close to socialism in the minds of most, unfortunately. So,
I'm depressed.
Oh, no, it gets worse. That's WOB Radio. We gently caress you into the nightmare of modern reality, and then we show you the way out, hopefully, through industrial unionism.
Well, then, think of all the more thousands and thousands of people across the country that will be, and in certain areas, especially where there's more of that business, but they would be absolutely applying for social services. And so that's going to overpower the social service system. And certain groups are trying to eliminate those services.
First of all, I love your optimism that anyone my age or younger is ever going to qualify for social services. That bank account is going to be empty by the time I get to 60, because this is not expanding anytime soon. So,
well, this isn't about being older. This is about getting like food stamps and financial help. If you have no work and there's no hope of work,
and if they have no tax money going to those programs, as some people need to be taxed more than others,
right?
Then we're all going to be.
Okay, let's get back on track, because I liked that you ended with IWW showing you the way out.
And worker solidarity and the power of a union in general. Yes, the IWW, but just the fact that there are hundreds of thousands of people currently on a picket line, the fact that there are tens of thousands of people currently organizing their workplaces, and the fact that, and this is leading into our next story, not to cut this off at the bud, but the fact that there are even more strikes being threatened. For example, the UPS workers just got a new contract offer from UPS, and that stopped, hopefully, a 340,000 worker strike that was going to occur in the following
month. I hope it was a good contract. Do you know any details?
Yes, I do.
Thank you.
Thank you to NPR and their soft-spoken radio presenters. So on July 25th, the Teamsters Union reached a tentative contract agreement with UPS, securing wage increases for the 340,000 workers it represents, and narrowly averting a nationwide strike after weeks of stalled negotiations. Teamsters leadership had threatened with a disruptive walkout if the company failed to meet their economic demands. Rank-and-file union members are casting their ballots until August 22nd, so that's in 10 days after the date of this recording. We are recording on the 12th. For the deal to go into effect, it needs to pass by, as the article suggests, a simple majority vote, which I think hopefully it will. If not, then I hope the workers take to the picket line. While Teamsters leadership is boasting of historic gains, Morris isn't convinced the deal does enough to fairly compensate and protect UPS employees, especially part-timers who make up the majority of the company's unionized workforce and whose strenuous work the delivery giant relies on. Under the 5-year agreement, wages for existing part-timers would be raised to no less than $21 an hour, which is in some parts of the country huge, with subsequent increases over the course of the contract. There are a lot of gains, Morris says, but then the $21 an hour is below our expectation. So the wages here as they are might be the breaking point. because they are getting other protections through this proposed new contract offered by the company. But
what other protections do you know?
Let's see.
I think there was something about getting rid of the surveillance cameras in their vans.
That would be good.
Well, they're not only on the clock, but there's a virtual stopwatch behind these guys and gals.
It's the slow Amazonization, to make up a new word on the airwaves. It's the slow Amazonization of other workplaces. And speaking of that, funny enough, my last workplace, which was a warehouse job with a very notable, very progressive company that I will not name because I do not want to be crap-talked to future employers, but they were facing that problem as well. They realized that in the warehousing industry, in the wholesale industry, specifically for the market that I was working in, a lot of the things that Amazon does, the stuff that we all here at the table hate, is beginning to expand as common workplace practice, and surveillance is one of those things. Mm-hmm. I had a scanner on my arm, and it would record exactly what I was doing, what I was scanning, where I was putting it. You know, if I was on break, obviously, or if I was on lunch, you know, you just log out of the system altogether, but it would always have a little bar on there saying, you are currently doing stocking, or you are currently helping with inventory, or you are currently, currently breaking down cardboard, setting up new bins, et cetera, et cetera. It always tells you what's going on, and that's just the gentle part of it, you know. It is still easy to find loopholes in those kinds of systems, but it's getting to the point where the surveillance is so constant, so atomized, so minute. They're knowing every single thing you're doing on the job and using that as a justification to talk poorly about your productivity, potentially cut your wages, potentially fire you. Speaking of which, this is continuing from the NPR article. Along with wage increases, UPS agreed to equip new delivery vehicles with air conditioning, end forced overtime, and eliminate a two-tier pay system for delivery drivers, amongst other concessions. That was actually one of the biggest issues, was that there was a tiered payment program.
We have to fight against that garbage.
Yeah. If we're all doing the same kind of work, we should all be getting paid the same kind of wage across the board.
It should be noted, I think, that none of these new labor struggles, when we've heard about Amazon and we've heard about UPS, this wouldn't have happened without the recent democratizing movement within the AFL trade unions.
That's right.
Yes.
Because for years and years, they were fighting against the Hoffa faction and the Teamsters.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a mobbed up and it was a corrupt union. And everybody knew it.
Mm-hmm.
But the what was it? Teamsters for a Democratic Union.
Yes.
TDU finally won their slate. And that's when we started seeing some movement on the UPS front. Before, the union leadership was not responsive to the rank and file. Now it's way more democratic. I don't precisely know how they structure their stuff. But before, you couldn't vote for a steward. Stewards were selected. Business representatives were selected by the union. And you didn't have, as a worker, you had very little input. And of course, they had goons. They had enforcers for the union leadership. It's, you know, a lot of what you read is true. So this wouldn't have happened without the democratizing efforts in the existing trade unions, including United Auto Workers.
Mm-hmm.
They finally got a democratic slate in. So some of the old AFL unions that have been infamous for decades and decades of being corrupt and not for the worker, that's beginning to change. And so more power to them.
I would also like to jump off on that fact that I think the other thing that's significantly changed is that with the larger influx of new workers into the union, especially younger workers, workers working in new trades that haven't previously existed, I think a lot of the complacency factor in a lot of these bigger trade unions have mm-hmm. kind of worn off, because historically it was, here's the new contract, this is the best you're going to get, sign here on the dotted line, vote for it if you want it. We'll only strike as the very, very, very last possible initiative against our employers, whereas now it's kind of like the younger workers are teaming up with the older, more experienced workers and kind of going, we're kind of all in the toilet here together, and we can either take right to the picket line and show them that we mean business, or we can continue to put up with this for decades and decades and decades. So I think that just because of the worsening conditions in this country, there is a stronger solidarity of, we're all in this together, and we either hang separately or we picket together. So,
you know, I think that's a direct outcome of COVID, too.
Mm-hmm.
Because Essential workers were so badly treated during COVID that they finally really began to see the truth.
Yes, I came to the union. I came to the IWW in large part because of COVID and because of watching all of these people, in some cases, die at the grocery store or die on the factory line or die out in the field of agriculture.
Bus drivers
as well. Healthcare workers getting burnt out and leaving the industry entirely just because it was a removing of the veil of this is how badly we're going to treat you just to make sure that that imaginary black line keeps moving upward. Mm-hmm. And how much those companies and those executives gained over that period of time. Despite all the headlines saying the economy is doing worse, we're having supply chain issues, it's like, you folks are making billions and billions and billions more dollars in net profit, and while the smaller businesses or the worker co-ops are getting screwed out of a good deal or out of existence in many cases, those larger businesses like Amazon and UPS and Hollywood just kept growing.
I keep thinking of the line from the Ann Feeney song. And listener, if you don't know who Ann Feeney is, Google her. She had a line from her song, and it said, "We just came to work here. We didn't come to die."
Yes.
Actually, that song was written by Harry Stamper.
By who?
Harry Stamper.
I didn't know that.
Longshoreman Coos Bay. And Harry's left us. Hmm. But I think I signed him up in the union because he wanted to perform for the AFL-CIO in Oregon. Mm-hmm. But a union musician said, "Well, that's not fair. I'm a musician. I should get paid for this." And Harry said, "Well, I'm a Wobbly. I'm a musician and a longshoreman. And you don't have to pay me. Yeah. I just want to come play."
Yeah.
And so he did. And he wrote that song.
Thank you. And that you're listening to Al. Al's been very quiet this whole show. Al is the collective memory of a lot of things. So what was the man's name again?
Harry Stamper.
Harry Stamper?
Stamper, yeah.
Okay, Harry Stamper wrote that song. And Ann Feeney recorded it, but Harry Stamper wrote it. "We just came to work here. We didn't come to die."
And there's more to that song. You should look that up. Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah.
Just to finish off this article here, there has been some feedback from the workers about this new contract that's being proposed between the union and the UPS executives. Christina Paxton, a part-time package handler in Reno, Nevada, says she's content with the hourly pay raise she would see, $23.20, up from her current rate of $19. Quote, "I saw enough movement in the contract to get us in a spot where I don't have a reason to vote no." Paxton said, "Our last contract really took us backward, so for us to make progress is huge for us. But some employees are pointing to the company's recent economic gains as evidence that it can afford to raise starting wages more. UPS posted a record profit last year as the company reached $100 billion in revenue for 2022 for the first time. Jennifer Hancock, a part-time package sorter, has worked for UPS for more than 3 decades. She's an organizer with Teamsters Mobilize, an employee group that aims to level the playing field for part-time workers." This is also one of those democratic institutions mm-hmm. that you were mentioning, fellow worker Gordon. An employee group that aims to level the playing field for part-time workers. Hancock said she thinks that the economic elements of the deal could go further, like establishing a $25 an hour base rate for part-timers. So there is, again, like I said, the two-tier pay system for drivers is getting taken away. Drivers are getting much better benefits. Part-time package handlers are finally getting the raises that they need. But the fact that these companies make so much money off of these workers in general, they could always bump up the wages. They can always bump up the benefits. And what we're beginning to see here, at least as evidenced by this article, is that workers are going, $23 an hour is great, but $25 an hour allows me to enjoy the rest of my life and afford to live. Yeah. So, you know.
Well, and pay my bills, because let's be honest about what's happening with the cost of living.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Katie Porter, who's a really gutsy congresswoman from California, don't remember the district, she questioned Jamie Dimon on the Senate floor or House, I forget which, about, you know, giving him specific examples of someone who works for him in an entry-level job and how rent costs typically this, food is this, you know, too much income for getting Medicaid and food stamps, but plenty of but very poor wages. And so she's, and then they have a child, you know, and, or then her husband leaves her. So she's going through realistic situations,
right,
of what a work life of just one woman is. And she says, and then this woman, your average, what you paying her is X amount per year. You make, you know, $32 million a year, for example.
A minute or whatever.
And it's just, it was really specific. And he just was like, not saying much. But she's just so hard-hitting. I hope she's reelected each time. But
does anybody remember that was really the cool author who wrote the book Nickel and Dimed?
Barbara Ehrenreich.
Barbara Ehrenreich.
Yeah.
Yep.
Listener, if you haven't read that book...
You should.
You should, yes.
I've read that book. It was a very sobering read, mm-hmm, just to see how, you know, the rank and file working class has had their rights and their pay in adjustment to the cost of living and everything just filed down over the decades. It's wild. And I mean, I'm kind of experiencing that right now too, because I just got a new job, and even though I'm getting paid, you know, quite a bit more than my previous position, what the job requires of me just to get this wage is so strenuous and is heavily detailed oriented. There's a lot of heavy lifting. There's a lot of transportation. You know, you kind of feel like you're getting ground down to dust for over the course of 14 hours. And I mean, I'm not going to balk at $26 an hour. That finally lets me have an actual savings account that grows to some measure by the end of the year. But, you know, there are other ways that the cost of living sneaks up on you too, and even when you get these nice wage increases from, you know, 19 to 25 or 26 or 27, on the other hand, it's like, well, you're currently between insurance, so what I had to do the other day was pay $1,100 for a bottle of pills. That's a sobering reality. Oh, yeah. And I called, and, you know, I was trying to figure out where my insurance was, and it's like, well, you know, you still haven't signed on to the company insurance because you had to wait this amount of time in order to get on it, as a lot of company policies do.
Well, and in all honesty, you know, as working folk, you work for years and years and years, and that takes a toll on your body.
Yes.
So basically, the system is using up our bodies, and then when we can no longer work,
we use up the rest of our wages.
Yeah.
Yeah. So hopefully the UPS workers, it sounds like a lot of them are in favor of this contract. Obviously, this is a pretty significant pay raise. And I'm not even just talking about this part of the country where 25 to 26 will at least help you make ends meet. They have facilities in more rural areas as well, where the cost of living is still increasing. But when you live in an environment where you need, you know, maybe only $21 an hour and you're finally getting $25 an hour, it means that, like I said, you can have a savings. You can be able to put money aside for emergencies or taking your kids to the seashore or, you know, making an investment in a new car, trying to find a new place to live. I mean, that money matters at the end of the day. And hopefully they do manage to fight for more before they vote on this contract, because I think that they can get it. If a company can make $100 billion in gross revenue, I think that they can afford to pay their workers a little bit better.
What's to prevent, as what happened to the railway workers when they were threatening to go on strike?
The government stepped in.
The Biden administration, the liberal progressive Biden administration,
screwed
them to the deck, and said, no, you cannot go on strike. This is a vital industry. Which harkens back to the United States steel strike back in the 1950s, you know, where they forced the workers to go back without arbitration. Okay, same thing could happen in this regard.
Air traffic controllers. Look what happened there.
Patco got busted.
Yeah,
that was that was Reagan's calling card right there.
Yeah, his first
move. And it did. I knew a rigger in the shipyard who was a former air traffic controller, and you know that astonished me because. Here he's working a real physical trade, being a rigger in the shipyard or any kind of work like that where you're lifting and hauling delicate machinery and heavy loads. You know, that's a hard job. And air traffic controller, they sat at a console. But that whole union got busted and dissolved, and we were put at risk. They had to use, remember that? They had to use military air traffic controllers to come in, which was used in the military to fill civilian jobs, which is unconscionable. But what I'm saying is that 340,000 package delivery people can tie this economy up like a pretzel. And that's why they're going to step in, I believe.
I was going to say that about the rail strike. I mean, that was only, 60,000, 65,000 workers that would have gone on strike?
Right.
this would have been 340,000. And they're just as related to the transportation industry of this country. Mm-hmm. They're just related to the retail industry of this country, to, you know, manufacturing industry of this country, so right. on and so forth. I mean, I kind of wish they would go on strike.
Yeah.
I wish we had hundreds of thousands of people on the picket line, because while nobody wants to be on a picket line because you're out of work and you're only getting whatever the strike fund will give you, that is the most powerful and effective tool that we have. And
if we go out on strike, I'll bring you pizza, personally.
Yes. Or we can have, what were those potatoes that we had before we recorded?
Those were East Coast Jewish potato salad.
We can bring them some of that as well. But they need the carbs to keep marching. So, yeah, hopefully the UPS workers get what they want out of this deal. UPS can afford it, and if they go on the picket line, then we'll see them on the picket line.
One more point.
Oh, Lynn's got something.
Okay, too.
Oh, and Al does, too.
I'll go last.
Well, one thing that young people especially should be encouraged to do is learn about pensions and how vital they are.
Oh,
and you get those through a union, usually. And it could be government workers, could be a trade, could
That's
be someone
true.
With a bachelor's degree in a specific field. But they have to have that on whether or not Social Security exists or pays much in the future. And so that would be such a strong call for unionization, too.
Yeah.
We want those pensions back, damn it. Anyways, well, Gordon, you had something?
When we were talking about the railroad workers and how many, you know, 65,000 or whatever it was that were threatening to go out on strike, the thing is that the railroads still have about 13 different unions representing the various trades and
right.
crafts. If they organized by industry, like the IWW and later the CIO, did when, you know, we always like to use the example of airlines because you can picture it. You know, if the pilots, the baggage handlers, the mechanics, the flight attendants were all in the same union, they could dictate to the airlines their wages and conditions. And same thing for the railroads. But in general, organizing by industry is the key to success for the working class.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for setting that up for me. I want to go back to the airline.
Go ahead.
I'm good at that.
If I were a pilot, and I'm not, but I would refuse to fly.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, well, call it a union if you want to, or I'd say it's the safety and the health and the lives of my passengers and myself.
That's right.
I mean, I'd like a competent person to be reading that scope as they bring them in. Go to a major airport, and there's three layers of planes, each going in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really hard to maintain that. So I think that the airline pilots should have done more to refuse.
In solidarity.
To work. Well, it's not just, we're trying to avoid the union issue. I'm just saying, if I was a pilot and I had passengers,
mm-hmm.
they're in my hands. I'm responsible for that.
Yep.
And I want the best help I can get. So this is Ronald Reagan, right? And let's go back. It's been 50 years since that guy did the little graph on the back of an envelope saying that if we tax the rich too much, they'll just stop working and, oh, we'll be in trouble then, won't we? The trickle-down theory?
Yeah.
It's been 50 years, and how successful has that been?
Great.
I just want to remind you about that. Well, for somebody, yeah, it's been really good.
Reaganomics may not be here blatantly, but it is still in effect.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Speaking of worker solidarity and marching together on the boss, the Donut Workers United, and this is from It's Going Down, this was posted on July 31st, the IWW workers at Voodoo Donuts marched on the boss in Portland and issued demands, and this is their official statement from Donut Workers United. The members of Donut Workers United have asked for your time today to address ongoing issues at Voodoo Donut that we feel affect us and have become increasingly intolerable. We would like to reassure you that this is not an attack on any particular manager or supervisor's character, but instead a critique of how the restaurant is being managed internally by members of management, supervisors, and Voodoo Donut as a company collectively. First and foremost, we would like to address the matter of basic human respect on the shop floor. Though workers try their best day in and day out to treat their fellow workers, supervisors, and managers with common decency and respect, we the workers feel that our hard work and generosity are being taken advantage of. Furthermore, we do not feel as though we are being treated with kindness, respect, and understanding. Time and time again, workers are being talked down to, disrespected, yelled at, verbally harassed, and overall we feel like we are being treated with a complete and utter lack of empathy. Not only are we tired of being disrespected on the shop floor while trying our best, we are constantly being undermined and belittled by certain supervisors and managers alike. If a worker could do a job better, we would like to be shown how, not yelled at. If a worker is injured, we would like to continue working without being criticized or belittled for the difficulties an injury creates. If a worker is sick or struggling with health issues, we would like the bare minimum of care and empathy. Recently, both Tanner and Nolan, two fellow workers, were fired without warning for their own health-related issues. These workers continued to try their best to maintain their ability to work, and yet management did not empathize with them, attempt to make accommodations, or take into consideration that working in a sweltering kitchen during the hottest days of the summer may have an impact on these workers' overall performance. We are people, not machines. We work as hard as we can, when we can. If we are not disposable, we are not disposable, and our struggles are valid. We show up to work attempting to do our best, while management continues to throw us away, seemingly without an ounce of remorse or for the repercussions that come with a worker losing their job. So this is an instance of...
What date was that?
This was posted by It's Going Down on July 31st. This took place a couple weeks ago.
Okay. Is there a link where people can go to support the workers?
Not that I can immediately see on this particular article, no. However, if you would like to reach out to Donut Workers United, or if you would like to potentially join them on the picket line, they are down in Portland, Oregon, through the Portland IWW branch. So okay. I'd probably reach out to the Portland IWW branch to find out ways to potentially support those workers if a strike is potentially going to be called over this. And I'd like to continue their ultimatum that they made to their employers. Donut Workers United is demanding an end to verbal abuse from managers and supervisors, an end to sexual harassment by all members of staff, including supervisors and management, an end to threats upon our jobs by supervisors and managers alike, competent and thorough training for all stations of the workplace, care and understanding for those struggling with health issues, an end to being overworked due to short staffing, clean and healthy workplaces, effective and non-damaged equipment such as oven gloves, which protect workers from grease burns. We would like Tanner and Nolan, those two fellow workers who were fired over health-related issues, to be both apologized to by management and have the option to have their jobs back. And lastly, the union demands that Voodoo Donut meet with Donut Workers United at the bargaining table. And if these demands are not met, we will have no choice but to escalate. So this is a threat of escalation and potentially strike. These workers organized a couple years ago during the COVID-19 pandemic.
I remember.
Yes, we were following that news closely on the radio, as well as over social media and our Facebook page. And it seems like the harassment from management has not stopped, so it looks like they might be going to strike soon.
Before we take a break, I want to add a final point that I should have brought up earlier. In terms of Ronald Reagan and the air traffic controllers, remember that Ronnie was also president of the Screen Actors Guild.
Yeah.
Yep.
Once upon a time, long time ago.
Yeah.
But where'd that get us?
He was also governor of California when there was the whole issue with the universities and Berkeley and People's Park. What a fine, upstanding person he isn't.
Isn't he, isn't he the one who ended free tuition in California?
Yep.
In conclusion, to our labor report here, we wish all of our solidarity to our fellow workers in the union at Donut Workers United. We hope that you get your demands met. And if you take to the picket line, we hope to be able to make it down there to support you. And if any of our fellow listeners would like to continue supporting Donut Workers United or learn more about their organizing campaign, you can always reach out to the Portland branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, or you can check out the Donut Workers United Facebook page. They have plenty of news updates going on there.
Thank you.
As to what their union is up to. So, and now moving on to our roundtable discussion, we're going to be continue off on the last conversation we had, which was specifically talking about intergenerational conflict that we've seen a lot in the media. Things about, you know, baby boomers versus millennials versus Gen Z, generational differences in workers and their attitudes about, you know, how work should change, how the economy should change, and what lessons we can...
And how interactions should change.
And how interactions should change as well, yes. Here in the IWW, we talk a lot about, you know, the working class versus the employing class, how power needs to go to the working class, and I think that there are some interesting aspects to these kinds of conversations that are taking place because I think that there are important lessons that older workers can pass off to younger workers.
And vice versa.
And vice versa, especially in the kind of changing socioeconomic climate that we have where a lot of workers are getting squeezed more and more out of their wages.
Where I want to go with this to begin with may seem like a sidetrack, but what I've come to realize is that groups that are generally comprised of younger workers, groups like the Sunrise Movement or similar ones, have very little tolerance for older workers. We get blamed, and sometimes rightly so, for the mess that our climate is in. And part of that is due to our own ignorance at the time. Mm-hmm. We didn't realize what we were doing.
A lot of that information was also suppressed. So yeah. Looking back, yeah. It's kind of hard to blame an entire generation for information that was not readily available.
That's true. But some people have no problems blaming us. Mm-hmm. And partly also what happens is that language has changed. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the gender recognition. Now, I'm keenly aware of the fact that LGBTQ people, their lives are threatened. Their existence is threatened. God knows what the Trump did and the DeSantis in Florida and the right-wingers are doing.
Going all the way back to Reagan with right. The AIDS crisis.
Erasing, or at least trying to erase or kill LGBTQ people.
It is a hard acronym. I won't blame you.
Well, that's okay. That's okay. People that are that, are young people, are very vocal in demanding proper recognition. Mm-hmm. Because their lives depend on it.
Right.
But as an older person, when I have difficulty wrapping my head around the acronyms, wrapping my tongue around the acronyms, being respectful of somebody's wish to be referred to as they, I don't mind being corrected. That's fine. I need to be corrected. Right. I need to be reminded. But sometimes I forget. And I'm treated sometimes as if I am willfully eliminating them. I mean, aside from the fact that my feelings get hurt, mm-hmm. I feel like I'm shoved aside.
I completely understand that. I mean, I think a lot of the complexity, especially around LGBT issues, has been the fact that, you know, like you said, the language of expression has changed so much. And I mean, we could talk about this in politics, we could talk about this in economics, and especially when it comes to social and cultural issues like the LGBT community. I think just the fact that we live in such an information age, I think that it can be very difficult to kind of keep up with what's appropriate to say, what's not appropriate to mm-hmm. say, how we navigate those conversations with a tone of respect so that people who want that education but don't know how to appropriately approach it can have that opportunity. I've always kind of joked around with a couple of, as a queer person myself, I've always kind of joked around with some of my queer and trans friends, you know, maybe we should just create like a college course, like a 101 course on like, here's where the situation is today with like queer theory and with like trans rights issues and stuff like that, just as like a sit down course for people that want it. And I mean,
I take that course.
Yeah. I'll monetize it so I get a couple cents in my pocket. I say that tongue in cheek because there are a lot of online courses out there that people make to just grift. But I think that that would be genuinely helpful. I mean, yeah. The one mission that WOB Radio has always tried to do is try to inform people about what is going on with an intersectional working class that is fighting a class war. And when it comes to things like race or comes to things like the LGBT community, how that folds into that broader perspective. So,
well, and then to go back to the issue again, mm-hmm. as an older woman, it is so easy to be shoved aside by this society, mm-hmm. to become invisible or be made invisible. Now, the Grey Panthers, that was a great organization.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about the Grey Panthers?
Well, I don't know much about the history, but I do know that they existed. And what the whole purpose of them was to demand their rights.
It was Age and Youth United in Action. Maggie Coon, I was a member.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, way.
Well, and Lynn and I are both members of the Raging Grannies, which is also an organization that makes a point of being seen and heard and demanding our respect and our rights.
Yes, absolutely.
Music can reach people in different ways from the spoken word.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, we in the IWW have always known that. We always sing a song out of these little red song books at the start of every episode. And the reason why we do that is because that's always been a tradition in the union, is that we're a fighting union, but we're a singing union too. And we know that those songs can have an impact on people in ways that long lectures about class analysis and how a union works doesn't always reach people. So sometimes it's better to put it into song. I think that from the perspective of a younger fellow worker, and as somebody who does work alongside more experienced older fellow workers or other activists and stuff like that, I think that The great tragedy of the labor movement is that there was a period of time from 1900 to 1945 where we had the greatest union growth in this country, where we had the greatest union strength in this country. We had the funding that we needed in order to have things like strike funds and pensions and stuff like that, and we fought for those things explicitly. It was came out of a much more militant generation of, at one point, younger workers that were being more and more exploited.
Right.
And then there was this period of time, and I think this is where some of the resentment against baby boomers comes from, is that there was a period of time between 1945 and, I would say, probably as late as the year 2000, where a lot of those gains made by organized labor were lost. There was kind of this passing on of responsibility to the next generation of organized workers that fell through, and I think that it's very easy to get resentful at that particular group of people because we kind of look up and say, well, that was kind of your responsibility. But then looking back, you also have to take into account things like Taft-Hartley. You have to take into things like Ronald Reagan busting the air traffic controllers, or labor law becoming more restrictive, or labor unions becoming internally corrupt. They're just there to, you know, there were some union
officials. Were a lot of factors that caused that.
Right. And so taking it from a, and I hate to be a class reductionist, I do not try to aim towards that line of thinking, but to look at it with a class analysis, baby boomers were just as exploited as younger workers in a way. Maybe at a different time, maybe at a different place, they still had some of the benefits from that earlier organizing that took place in the earlier 20th century, but they were just as exploited and they lost a lot. So looking back, I'm kind of like, that's not really a baby boomers are at fault situation. That's the people in power created a reactionary movement against labor to infringe on those rights as much as possible, to exploit those workers even harder, so that when millennials and later Gen Z now are starting to enter the workplace, there is that deficit of labor rights. There is that deficit of wage increases, because in a lot of ways, the baby boomers had just as hard of a fight to fight. Unfortunately, they had a lot stronger of an opposition. The business class got smart, and the trade unions at the time got complacent. And a lot of that is out of our control.
I want to hear what Gordon's got to say about this.
Well, actually, I think Lynn kind of...
The end of World War II, 1945, there was a huge upsurge due to the GI Bill of people being able to go to college and technical schools. My dad was in the Aleutians and in Okinawa as an Army sergeant, right? And he went to design school on the GI Bill. It was all paid for. That paved the way because, you know, that was the victory, the victory benefit that we got from World War II was a great upsurge in technical and college education. So, in a sense, the government created its own backlash. And it made it intergenerational, and it breaks my heart because I've felt that same vibe, is that people are just tolerating the fact that I was there, you know, and as if I had nothing to offer. There were a couple of things that happened in 1954. The AFL merged with the CIO sort of forcefully, and the CIO had to get rid of all their left-led organizers.
Mm-hmm. And some of whom were the most militant and some of the most famous figureheads of that union.
Right. Well, the Reuther brothers, Walter Reuther, A. Philip Randolph was still around. You know, we had militant labor leaders that got purged out of the CIO by the government, essentially. So that was another thing. And then in 1971, the Powell Memorandum came out, which was an open war on labor. Right. And Powell later got appointed by Nixon to be a Supreme Court judge, you know, so he got his payoff, like Clarence Thomas continues to reap.
And the rest, almost the rest of them. Yeah.
Well, the thing is that there's been corruption and there's been skullduggery at the highest levels. And don't forget, the IWW was damn near wiped out after World War One. We had our leaders deported. We had our leaders jailed. We had people lynched, killed, beaten up, right? So there was an active campaign against organized labor right after World War One and all through the 20s, and people got imprisoned because of it. So the labor leaders of the purged and merged AFL-CIO learned their tricks from their employers. And they literally, the AFL model was based on corporation model, with the idea being that if we acted like a corporation, you know, we could deal better with them. And that was Samuel Gompers. So that was way back. That's why the IWW was formed.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM, KTAH.
In reaction to the
AFL. So they were basically saying that if we act like a corporation, that's the same thing as solidarity.
Well,
but it isn't.
They didn't use that word. I mean, solidarity got bandied around after 1954.
Yeah.
They still use the word, but it has nothing to do with the spirit of solidarity that unions like the IWW, and there were others that were very progressive. UE is still around. UE decided they were not, that's the electrical workers, what is it, the radio and machine workers. Anyway, their nickname is UE. And they're the alternative to the IBEW. IBEW is an AFL union. These guys did not give up their radical principles, and they're still around, but that only by, you know, dint of ideological commitment. So there's a lot of reasons, but ageism works both ways, right? And arguably, ageism is just another tool in the kit bag of capitalism, along with racism, along with, you know, favorability to certain religious or ethnic groups.
Or genders.
Or gender. Yeah, and gender is a hard one to learn after a certain age, because I was raised in a traditional, I guess you'd call it, atmosphere. So LGBTQ people were marginalized. Mm-hmm. And I totally understand that feeling and the resentment that can be bred by that. But what younger workers have to realize is that, yeah, we had to go through our own version of this crap, and now it's just your turn going through this, you know, and we're here to support you. Older workers are here to support you, and we look for your input. So don't just condemn us out of hand because we might be of a certain race or gender, or your perception of how I might think, right, is not necessarily the reality of what I think. So be open. Adhere to your own principles. Be open-minded. I mean, it's wonderful that LGBTQ people these days are way more accepted, way safer, I would argue, than they were when I was a kid back in the 50s and 60s.
We do have more legal protections, I will say. And legal. That has been of great benefit.
Indeed.
Hard-fought legal protections, but legal protections nonetheless.
Well, that was Stonewall.
What I would like to be able to offer younger organizers and workers is, when valid and appropriate, we have experiences that we could share and strategies that have been tried that either worked or did not work that might be of value to younger people today.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can be more open-minded to our occasional input, I personally found that I can learn so much from young people, but maybe there's things I can offer too.
Indeed. And it should be symbiotic.
This is not, I don't have the sociological or historical knowledge about this, but I'm surmising that after World War II, when education was more accessible to many more people, in particular men at that time, a lot of people went to universities and colleges that couldn't have or didn't in the past. And I think that took, and then they're the people that retire from state government and, you know, all kinds of different professions. But so I think that possibly the trade suffered in terms of membership, and so many other people were
good point. Off.
And then tuition was so much more reasonable. When I went to college in the 60s, late 60s, it was like $125 a semester or something like that. Mm. It was like really affordable for my parents. My dad was a veteran of the war.
Yeah, that makes sense. But what they were doing, they were preventing a revolution. They were finally giving the working class a ladder, albeit it got pulled up after that generation, which some have called the greatest generation. The ladder got pulled up. I kicked myself in the pants because I could have gone to City University in New York or any of the borough college, Brooklyn College, Queens College. I could have gone for free. The only thing I would have had to pay for is my books. But I didn't. And look what happened. I ended up getting drafted. But that's another tale.
Yeah.
But I agree with what you're saying, that opportunity was offered. But I take a cynical view of that. It was offered because they knew if they didn't give
that's
a ladder,
right.
there'd be a revolution.
That's
and
exactly
that
right.
That was a lesson they learned after the First World War.
Yes.
Because there were soldiers that were denied their pensions and benefits for well over a decade after the war concluded. Mm-hmm. And it led to one of the biggest protests in D.C., at that time, before the 60s and 70s, which was, it was a mass of tens and tens of thousands of World War One veterans,
that's
led by Smedley Butler,
yeah.
who went to Washington, D.C.
And camped out.
And Eisenhower and Patton drove tanks through their encampment and killed a couple of them, including a small child, and evicted them from D.C. So, no, they knew that the soldiers coming back from the Second World War needed protections, needed benefits.
Oh, I see where you're going.
Yeah, because they knew that a repeat of what happened to the First World War veterans would occur.
Right, the bonus army, they called themselves, and that was Douglas MacArthur
mm-hmm.
practicing his theatrics there, too.
Yes.
And yeah, Patton, the maniac, was in on it.
Funny coincidence, though. Smedley Butler was later recruited by the business plot in order to rally up those same soldiers to go back to D.C. and stage a coup.
Right, and that's
a fascist coup. And a lot of the people who got implicated in that never faced charges or never went to court, some of which included some pretty big names.
I want to get back to the conflict thing.
Yes. I think the quote that I was looking for, and I can't remember, it was a left-leaning educator or revolutionary, I can't remember who it was, but the quote goes something along the lines of this. We have to keep talking about these issues, whether it's class conflict, whether it's queer and trans rights, whether it's a population of aging people in this country who want to pass on their lessons that they learned from their activism and from their struggles. We have to keep talking and we have to keep educating. And I think that that does go both ways. I think mm-hmm. that you make a fantastic point that, you know, a lot of the younger workers today that are becoming organized and are forming unions in their workplace are taking directly those lessons that the IWW learned mm-hmm. from its strikes or from the
yeah.
older trade unions at the time, which were more militant. Especially the CIO, you know, a lot of the younger workers are taking lessons from that and applying that to the picket line or how they organize. You know, marching on the boss has come back
yeah.
as a major strategy for directly confronting your employer over grievances. You know, and I think that, like I said, it goes both ways. I think that a lot of the younger workers do have an obligation, not any one particular worker, not any one particular educator, but we do have to keep teaching our lessons as well and
absolutely.
Pass that on to the older generations, that the older generations can be equipped to join us on the picket line or to use inclusive language or to understand exactly how this class conflict and how this oppression is affecting marginalized communities. And I think, and you know, as somebody infamously put it on social media, if you look up critical race theory, if you type that into Google search, the top 3 out of 5 responses are all conservative think tanks, including PragerU.
Wow.
They are intentionally trying to misform people about what critical race theory is. There's also happening to LGBT issues. If you type in LGBT issues, there's a bunch of reactionary think tanks out there that are doing their own talking and are trying to fill up the airwaves and are trying to fill out the articles. So, yeah, it is our duty to keep talking about the class struggle or talking about queer and trans rights, because if we don't do the educating from our perspective, somebody else is going to do the educating from the other
That's
perspective.
That's a very, very good point.
You have to keep talking. I don't like this mentality of, it's not my job to teach you.
Mm-hmm.
I do not believe in that at all. I'm happy talking about queer issues. I'm happy to listen to other people about their intersections of oppression or their struggles as a member of the working class. Because even if you don't want to do the talking, some of us have to keep doing it. And it is exhausting. And it does get repetitive, and it does sometimes get irritating to have to keep talking about the same things over and over again so that everybody in the room gets what's going on. But that's still our obligation to one level or another.
Well, and I of course you're right.
Mm-hmm.
And as you're talking, I'm also thinking about the issue of climate chaos.
Yes.
And how desperate and depressed and anxious and sad
And angry,
many of us get. We can do all we can do, but then we see things happening in the world around us, whether it's wildfires in Maui destroying an entire town,
mm-hmm.
or floods and fires in Canada. We all see what's happening. And unless we can work across the barriers that the system sets up, barriers of race, barriers of gender, barriers of age, barriers of class, unless we can start to work across all of those, we have not got a prayer.
Nope.
And some people would tell you we don't have a prayer no matter what.
That's defeatism at its finest.
Yeah.
I can't, I especially when it comes to the conversation of climate change, you know, there is a phenomenon, especially on those of us, for those of us who are terminally online who might be listening, you know, there is this phenomenon of a quote-unquote doomer mentality. And the doomer mentality is basically, you know, obviously there are some right-wing circles of the internet that also reflect this, that, you know, I'm never going to have my beautiful two-story home and a trad wife who always is barefoot and cooking for me and stuff like that. That's the right-wing interpretation of it, which obviously is disgusting. There is this doomer mentality in a lot of younger workers, in a lot of people who are very much informed on things like climate change or the regression of LGBT rights in this country or the increasing cost of living and the further removal of labor rights. It's very easy to get into a mentality of there's nothing I can do about it because it's so overwhelming and it's coming for us all at once. And that doomer mentality is a dry rot that will eventually get you complacent and get you inactive in doing anything to change the situation. And I think that especially when it comes to issues like the climate crisis, it is kind of out of a lot of our hands. We can blame 100 to 101 companies who are directly responsible for 73% of all the emissions. That's a big boss to fight. But on the other hand, if we don't collaborate together as an intersectional working class, if we don't, like I say, keep up the talking, keep up the work, doing what we can, then nothing gets solved.
Yeah, there's no hope.
There's no cashing out on that kind of nihilistic perspective. You kind of have to keep fighting even when you don't want to. And I think that the older generation does have a good experience with that because they did have to go through a lot of fights that they did not want to fight. You know, the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the civil rights activism and the repression of the Black Panthers and the Brown Berets.
What keeps you in the game? What keeps you fighting? What gives you strength for the long haul?
Yes.
Because otherwise you burn out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that the older among us probably can pass on.
I mean, I think there was a lot of burnout, as I mentioned before, during that particular baby boomer generation of our unions are becoming more corrupt, the government is becoming more reactionary against labor rights. You know, there's a bunch of oppressed minorities that are still struggling to get basic decency, whether by the law or by society at large, so on and so forth. And I think that, you know, like I said, it's easier to blame the older generation for that, but when you haven't been there, you don't know what that experience
was
like.
Well, and one thing I've learned, and I'm sure that the other older people around the table have learned, is that we get older, our physical ability to do the marching and the picketing and all of those things is much more limited if we can do it at all.
Mm.
But I want to mention that Bill McKibben of 350, which is an organization dedicated to fighting climate chaos, started a group called Third Act. And Third Act is for us baby boomers that are in our third act. What can we do now? What can we do now that we are capable of that can help fight back against the climate chaos?
Mm-hmm.
Those of us that are older, mostly are retired, we have time. We may not be able to walk or march long distances, but we can write letters.
Mm-hmm.
We can call our Congress critters. Some of us are lucky enough to be able to donate money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we can do that will help.
Yeah. And I think as our obligation as younger workers is to help educate the older workers exactly how the situation has changed. Because a lot of the environment that the working class is currently engaged in, when you're facing things like AI potentially taking away your job, when you're facing corporations that have a lot more money in order to mm-hmm. fight legal battles against labor rights, or when you're facing a government that is increasingly becoming more reactionary towards minority activist organizations of that are fighting for LGBT rights or that are fighting for a broader expansion of civil rights, racism. Yeah, no, I think that it is our obligation as younger workers to educate older members, retired members of the working class, how the fight has changed and then what they can do. Because you're absolutely right. There's still a place for you, even if it's not at the picket line. If you can write a letter, if you can paint a poster, if you can...
phone calls during the working day.
Yeah. Or if you can find a way to, you know, pass on what education you have learned through your own experience as an activist or as a labor organizer.
If people are willing to listen.
Yes, please tell us, because we can still sift out the lessons that would still be applicable to our current situation. Like I said earlier, a lot of these younger organizers are going all the way back to the IWW's days and saying, well, we could talk to our steward, we could reach out to our union president, we can talk amongst each other as workers and figure out what to do. Or we can get directly back to agitating, educating, inoculating, and organizing, and then march on the boss, or have a one-day strike, or go back to sit-down strikes. Even if it breaks the law, there are some younger workers that are willing to take that risk because they're like, this passive attitude against militancy isn't working anymore. The situation is getting exponentially worse, and we have to go back to those old tactics. We have to see how those worked, and we can talk to people who actually got to live that out. Some of those old, you know, United Auto Worker organizers, or even some older members of the IWW who did take part in strikes, who were organized through an organized union, they can pass on those lessons to us, and we need those lessons more than ever.
Well, I know that tons of groups and individuals, you know, got into Zoom, which didn't used to exist. I don't know when it started, but and it became reasonably priced. And so I wonder, now that COVID is largely over, whether unions members still have or consider having meetings on Zoom, you know, online, whatever, because there's so much less participation in, well, civic things and, you know, events and meetings that one is a member of. It's starting, you know, in about the 90s with VCRs and, you know, being able to do things, see movies that you didn't used to be able to do at home. And then with computers and everyone's got their face in their cell phone all the time. It seems like that might be a way. I don't know what, I'm sure it varies a lot between unions, among unions. But as far as the participation, maybe that's something that they don't do and maybe they could, more participation.
Yes, fellow worker Gordon?
I've been reading a lot of IWW history. Specifically, the book I just finished was called Beyond the Rebel Girl, and it was about other women in the IWW who were pivotal and key to the struggle. And I am ashamed to say I've been a WOB since 2008, and I had never heard of Marie Ecky. I had never heard of Louise Oliveiro or Becky Beck. These were women who were imprisoned for their union activities. And in these books that I've been reading, I get the sense that the IWW, because the workforce was mostly men, okay, that was just a fact 100 years ago. And so women were sort of automatically relegated to a supporting role. However, the IWW women stepped to the forefront. They were unafraid to be targeted, really, by the right wing, and a lot of them paid a dear price for it. But what I'm getting at is that the IWW used to have union halls all over the place.
That's right.
And I think a return to that kind of brick-and-mortar idea is a good thing, because the union halls doubled as community centers. And there's been a big argument within our union about, are we workplace organizers or are we community organizers? Well, I make the argument that we're both.
That's right.
And that they do intersect a lot. And people can't think straight when they're hungry. People can't act right when they're being beaten by a baton. And the women back then really led the way for the men to be able to let their guard down. And the respectability issue of the day, you know, in the late Victorian era, really, or the Edwardian era in England, the morality either you were married or you were a prostitute, you know, which is of course absurd. A lot of women had to work just because their family conditions deteriorated, right? But what I'm getting at is that going back to the idea that we're talking union all the time, which means that we're organizing, agitating, educating all the time. And that goes to deep roots in the community. And the way to get the community on your side is to show them the practical benefits of being in an organization like the IWW. It should be, because the traditional unions now, I was a member of the Machinist Union for 30 years, and I think I went to like 3 meetings the whole time. They didn't encourage people to come to meetings. They liked it as their own little private club. And since I was a federal employee, you didn't have to join the union. And a lot of people didn't. And yet still, the first thing they would do if they were being harassed by a boss was to go get a union steward. I was a steward for a few years. And I know some of the phony complaints, you know, were just from people who just wanted to use the union. They didn't pay any dues, but by law, we had to represent them. So that kind of thing, if you had deeper roots in the community, if you had a union hall, which also doubled as a daycare, perhaps as a reading room, a place to come plug your computer in or your telephone and get it charged up. It was a place that was always occupied by people talking union, talking organizing, and talking the dismantlement of capitalism.
My God, Al, we got to reconstruct your building. It used to be a union hall. Let's do it.
Yeah.
So, I'm inspired.
Well, one thing is that in addition to all those other things, there were libraries.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A working person could hang out by a stove and get warm.
Yes.
Maybe there's coffee. There's books.
Yep.
People to talk to about books.
A lot of people learned history and polished up their reading skills.
There was English, history, the whole thing, yeah.
Right. And all those books were available for people to borrow. And I just wish we could sort of return to that. Well, you know, because what passes for community centers now is not very good. They're usually very limited in their scope. They suck up tremendous amounts of money. I'm talking organizations like the YMCA or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really community centers. They're only open certain hours, usually inconvenient hours for school children and for, you know, older people. Inconvenient, right? Union Hall could be something totally different. And reading these histories that I've been reading also tells me that we have to be ready to face a lot of oppression. And that's difficult for older people or more vulnerable people. You know, we don't want to get our heads knocked in. Been there, done that. But what I'm getting at, it's going to take a lot of courage. And the best way to have that is to have deep roots in the community.
Absolutely. And I think those are lessons that go way back and that older workers have better experience with because they had those spaces. There was once a time when a union hall could function as a community center as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is something that we need to start employing again. In terms of the IWW's capacity, you know, we've had a great gain in membership over these past few years. There's been much more successful organizing campaigns. We've had better donation rates and stuff like that. And speaking for the Tacoma IWW, we're about to have a new union hall that I think will be more accessible to fellow workers here in Tacoma. And hopefully we can build it up into a place where we can have that kind of capacity and that kind of outreach and that kind of support. I think the two lessons that I'm taking away from this is, one, it's the impetus of younger workers to inform older workers, those of us who are either older and still in the workplace and still organizing, or are currently retired and out of the workplace, to keep them informed. There does need to be some kind of, like Lynn said, some kind of way of networking with older fellow workers so that we can have those interactions, so that we can have those constructive conversations, so that those lessons can be passed on, so that those strategies that were once old can be implemented again. And I think that the other lesson that can be taken away from this is that older workers are eager to help out. They have suffered. Yes, even the baby boomers, my fellow young listeners, the baby boomers have suffered under capitalism too. And I think that we do need to extend more sympathy to them in that fact. And the fact that there has still been an ongoing class struggle in this country and an intersectional struggle against oppression in this country from those elder generations, we need to be taking those lessons and employing them. Because unless we go back to our militant roots and we start taking more direct action and we start using strategies that are high risk but get high reward, that's the path that we're beginning to take again. We see that in labor organizing. We see that in the environmental activists right now. We see that with people who are fighting against oppression against LGBT people, people who are fighting against
all
racism.
All of the struggles. All of the struggles.
Absolutely. We're going back to those militant roots because we're beginning to wake up and realize this complacent method of writing to your congressman or calling your representative or, you know, having a peaceful demonstration even. Yes, peaceful demonstrations are great for informing people, but what are we actually going to directly do about it? What's going to cause enough disruption to actually force the hand of capital and force the hand of the government to change its ways? and we're still figuring it out. And we appreciate
all the support. We have to disrupt.
Yep, we have to. And we appreciate all the support we can get, even if it is from somebody painting a poster or writing a letter or a leaflet or something like that.
Or donating.
Or donating, yes. And I think that there is still room for constructive conversations in the future about this, because I'm tired of reading all of these headlines about how it's boomers versus millennials, or it's millennials against the Zoomers.
Well, I've seen a really good trend.
Mm-hmm.
I have contact with a lot of different groups, and some of them tend to be younger people. I have seen with some of the younger groups a conscious effort to be more inclusive.
Absolutely.
Even of older people.
Mm-hmm. Or people who just, you know, older fellow workers who might not be as informed on current issues.
Well, I'm thinking of groups that make a point of when something needs to be corrected. They don't correct somebody publicly in front of a whole lot of people. They take them aside and gently point it out so that they're not humiliated in front of a whole group. And that takes not only awareness, but taking the time and empathy to actually try to get your message across rather than scoring correct points.
Right. Don't do it for your ego. Do it for the sake of actually educating other people and helping them be
better. I've seen that with groups.
Yeah.
And I definitely it just warms my heart.
Yeah. No, I mean, there are definitely other organizations that, you know, they denounce people who accidentally step out of line or who, you know, speak from an uninformed place.
And I think people are realizing that's not effective.
No, it's not. I think that's a very old style of management, even in more liberatory circles. Yeah. That can't happen. It shouldn't happen. We, like I said earlier, it's our duty to keep talking. It's our duty to keep educating, because if the workers don't, capital will. If the people who are marginalized and oppressed don't, the people who do the marginalizing and oppressing will.
One reason that we really should pay attention, not only to our union history, but the history in general, and the history of the labor movement, because there were examples, plenty of examples, back in the day. I mean, I'm talking about the colonial era.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about, you know, all the way through the Civil War, where diverse workers got together and actually just said, you know, to hell with this racism stuff. The Southern Tenant Farmers Union, I love them because their acronym is STFU.
Mm-hmm.
but also, you know, things like Local 8 in Philadelphia. I'm reading a book now called Wobblies on the Waterfront. And these guys just decided, hey, to hell with this racial prejudice and the separation of the workers, to hell with it. We can get more done together.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a majority black union. That was Ben Fletcher's outfit. But they also encompassed a huge swath of like Irish immigrants and Jewish immigrants, believe it or not. Longshore, you know, haul and freight, which was a lot different than they do it today, which is all containerized. But this hard, dangerous work, everybody realized that we got to spread this equally. And they would just drop the fashions of the day. Same with some of those IWW women that I mentioned. You know, they just broke the mold as far as what was expected of them and what they were allowed to do in public. And so if we reach back and look at these examples, you can see that it can work. It can work amongst everybody, and that we're artificially separated by race and by ethnicity and by gender identity and all this other stuff. It's just another tactic of capital to keep us divided.
At the risk of sounding religious, amen, brother.
You want your soapbox back?
I'm glad we had this conversation.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, in the face of the dearth of all these conversations about so-called intergenerational conflict, it's not a sin to poke fun at baby boomers for being slightly behind the times, but I think on a broader perspective, we need to be bringing older workers, older fellow workers, retirees into, whether that's the organizing struggle, whether that's a struggle against intersectional forms of oppression. Those people have lessons, and those lessons need to be respected.
Here's a disclosure. The Home in Tacoma for All, what I could do as a Third Act member is give them $20,000 for their campaign, and I did. Mm-hmm. And I did it gladly. You can't do that right now.
Nope.
And a lot of people can't. But that's something I can do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether that helps with your legal battles or whatever, it's something I can do.
And we want to thank you so much to our fellow listeners out there for tuning in. This has been a production of the Tacoma branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. If you would like to hear our show, you can go online to radiotacoma.org under their productions tab, and you can listen to all of our archived episodes. We are also broadcasting out of KTQA 95.3 FM and KZAX in Bellingham at 94.9 FM, and is currently being broadcasted out of KTAH Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM. We want to thank you so much for tuning in. We hope that all of you fellow workers out there stay safe and stay in the struggle, and we hope to see you again next month.